that tells the story of Princeton, a recent college grad who moves into a shabby New York apartment and meets other residents. Together, they struggle to find jobs, dates, and their ever-elusive purpose in life. Again, that's Avenue Q from June 8th through July 1st at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Friends of Noise Fest, a daytime music festival Sunday, June 25th at 4 p.m. at Disjecta in Portland. Friends of Noise Fest features 9 bands, including Waterfronts, Glacier Veins, Kuone, Shortline, After Hours, and more. There's also going to be food, art, and an opportunity to learn more about Friends of Noise and their mission to support all-ages music spaces in Portland. Again, that's Friends of Noise Fest, Sunday, June 25th at 4 p.m. at Disjecta, 8371 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 11 o'clock. Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, we got the food show. Chris is here with his guest and some recorded items that we'll get to in just a minute. Thank you for tuning into KBOO this morning. And here comes the food show.
Some food in my belly, need some drink for the dry in my throat, need for the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away, just because it ain't the right size or perfect, 'cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee.
Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. In a bit, I'll be talking with Jason Skipton, Executive Director of Growing Gardens. Growing Gardens works to cultivate vibrant, healthy communities by empowering people to grow their own food. We'll be talking about the work of the organization, food justice, and their upcoming fundraising series, Chef in My Garden. We'll also have our monthly conversation with permaculturist Marisha Auerbach. Summer is finally here, and that means we are in the most active part of the gardening season. Marisha has tips to stay organized and on top of all the gardening tasks that will usher in the harvest. But first, over the years, I've collected a number of food stories. I've talked with farmers, chefs, educators, activists, and innovators who've shared with me their passion and knowledge about food. I was recently going through my archive of stories and decided it was time to bring some of them out and share them with you. Throughout this hour, you're going to hear three of those stories. We're going to start with a story from Chef Brian Wilkie, who co-founded the Oregon Culinary Institute. When I was working at Wealth Underground Farm, Brian would buy produce from us and occasionally bring out some of his students to help us on the farm. He tells a story about a motorcycle trip he took in search of the best biscuits and gravy. Here's Brian's story.
I'll say 85 or 6. So we went up there and got married at the judge's place up in northern Minnesota. We got snowed in the boundary waters for a couple of days, which was kind of unusual. But that really whet our appetite to start traveling around, and motorcycles are motorcycles. You either do them or you don't. And about 2 years later, we quit our jobs and decided to take a six-month journey all across North America. I think we ended up doing almost 30,000 miles. And I think 46 states we went through. We went down all the way in Baja, California. We did that jaunt. We went all the way across Canada. And we really enjoyed it. So, of course, we ran out of money because we were young and dumb. And went back and got jobs for a few more years. And after a six-month jaunt to Mexico that lasted through the winter, we decided to gear it up again. And that spring and do another motorcycle run. So we started in Chicago, and it was the beginning of March, so it was still a little bit dicey up north. And we stopped in Cincinnati to visit some folks, and then headed down We decided to have a theme for this particular adventure, so I thought that I would search out the best biscuits and gravy in America. So every chance I got, I ordered it, and that's a hit or miss thing. Sometimes people make their own biscuits, sometimes they don't. Sometimes they make their own gravy, sometimes they don't. But I was looking for someone who was rather serious about their craft. And it was probably mid to late March by the time we hit the Blue Ridge Parkway, and none of the campgrounds were open at that time, so we were camping semi-illegally in a lot of places. Not semi, that was very illegally, I guess. And one morning, it was just freezing cold. It was like 26 degrees when we finally couldn't stand not moving around. So we got up and packed up and headed down the parkway, and we ran across this little town, I believe it was in North Carolina. And we opened the place up. We were waiting when they opened up at 6 o'clock, and walked in, and there was only one waitress around, and I was a little concerned about whether or not they accepted traveler's checks. That's how old this story is. And she said yes, so I asked her for a pen, and I couldn't even sign the traveler's check because I was shaking so hard. We were freezing, so of course we order a huge pot of coffee, and I go ahead and order the biscuits and gravy, and man, that was the spot. The search continued. We were on that motorcycle trip for another 5 or 6 months after that, and I must have had 50 or 75 more orders of biscuits and gravy around the country, but that was the holy grail. And the beautiful part about it was I told the woman what I was doing in my biscuit and gravy holy grail trip, and she just got this huge smile on her face and finally confided in us that while she wasn't the cook at that place, she arrived every day at 3 a.m. to make the biscuits. So we're still the only ones in the restaurant shaking like, you know, it was nuts. And we just made her day, man. She got the biggest smile. And right when we were getting ready to, you know, we were winding down, she brought out another biscuit and gravy. She was so happy that we enjoyed them. And that was really special and something I'll never forget. That totally set the bar that's never been surpassed since then. And that was 25 years ago.
That was Brian Wilkie, co-founder of the Oregon Culinary Institute. Throughout the hour, we'll hear a couple more stories from my story archive. And in a moment, I'll be talking with Jason Skipton, Executive Director of Growing Gardens. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio.
In December, drinking horchata, I'd look psychotic in a balaclava. Winter's cold is too much to handle. Pinch of crabs, the pinch at your sandals. In December, drinking horchata, look down your glasses at that aranciada with lips and teeth.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. I'm Chris Siegel. We talk a lot about growing your own food here on The Food Show, including our monthly garden conversation with Marisha. Growing a garden has the potential to empower an individual beyond just providing them with healthy and delicious foods. Growing Gardens, a nonprofit in Portland, is working to enhance communities by teaching people of all ages to grow their own food. They are also embarking on their summer fundraising series, Chef in My Garden, where some of the top chefs in Portland create intimate backyard meals for guests. To talk with us about growing gardens and the Chef in My Garden series, I'm joined by Jason Skipton, Executive Director at Growing Gardens. Jason, thanks for being on the Food Show.
Thanks for having me. Happy summer. It's finally here.
It is. So last month, we talked with folks over at Village Gardens, where you used to work. Could you give us a bit of your history with community gardening and garden education?
Yeah, for sure. So I was with Village Gardens for a little over 5.5 years. So love all the work that they're doing, and really grew as an individual, but also in my career over there. So love Village Gardens and what they're doing. This started for me a long time ago when I was growing up as a kid. We were a low-income family, and we're on government assistance, and really my mom kind of decided, what can we do differently? So I grew up in the garden, gardening in the summertime and picking raspberries and weeding carrots, and I didn't realize it at the time how much it was going to really impact my life and my career. So went to Portland State, got a degree in community development, and focused in sustainable agriculture, did my internship at the Oregon Food Bank when the Learning Garden was just starting. And then I really wanted to get engaged in a different culture. And so I joined the Peace Corps and was a Peace Corps agriculture volunteer in northern Nicaragua, where the majority of the Contra War took place, and lived and worked for 2.5 years with small subsistence red bean farmers. And really gained just a wealth of knowledge and really got the intimate experience of what it means to be farming, but also farming and living, and that rainfall decided if you ate or you didn't. And so we would dance when the rain came during the rainy seasons, because we knew that there was going to ensure a crop for the community. Through this work, I did a lot of focus around nutritional-based crops, and focused in one in particular, which is the Moringa oleifera tree. There's a lot of, that's a Latin name for it. There's a lot of other names around Latin America. It's native to India. But through that work, I got contacted by an organization in Guatemala, moved to Guatemala and worked with indigenous Mayan farmers. And then back to the Peace Corps, where I got hired as the agriculture technical trainer and trained all new ag volunteers in country. And then after about 5 years of living in Central America, moved back to Portland, and then got hired with Village Gardens and worked with them for 5.5 years. And then really wanted to just continue my education and really focus in and dig in more about what does this mean for community work and engaging communities. So went to Oregon State and got my master's in public health. And then did my research in La Paz, Bolivia, with a small nonprofit with the first urban community garden, really with the two questions for my research were, how does a community garden increase food security, but also how does it increase community participation?
Well, I kind of want to know that answer. how do community gardens help communities with food security?
Yeah, so something that I've noticed, I mean, across my work and my career over the last 16 years, is that it's a place to get engaged with individuals and really looking at food as the aspect of how to then unite communities around that focus in a positive way. And I'll be honest, it has to really be done in a mindful way. It can't just be get a vacant lot of land, build it, and then see what happens. Like, you have to be really mindful about who you're going to engage with the process, because you want it to be positive and you want folks to be engaged with it throughout the project. And so for me, it's been this opportunity to engage with all sorts of individuals who either have knowledge, gardening knowledge, agriculture knowledge, or they want to know that. And so it's been a very positive environment for folks to then come in and start putting seeds in the ground and seeing something positive come out of that. I've seen this happen, you know, in New Columbia when I was at Village Gardens. I saw it happen in rural Nicaragua. I saw it happen in the Mid-Highlands in Guatemala, in Bolivia, and that this is this common kind of trait for us as human beings, right? That we have this connection to land, and it hasn't been that far back in our history that we've been very intimately connected with that. And so the work that we're doing at Growing Gardens really embodies that, and it's inclusive, and we base our work in popular education, that we're all teachers and learners at the same time, that even though I'm the executive director at Growing Gardens, I don't have all of the answers to building a strong, vibrant, healthy community. That really comes from the community as well. And so it's a collaboration. It's a partnership that we're helping then provide education and access to land and resources and seeds and plants. But it's building community along the way.
So you're talking about community. At Growing Gardens, you use the experience of growing food to cultivate healthy, equitable communities. What does a healthy, equitable community look like?
Yeah, so what we've been doing at Growing Gardens, and we've been around for the last 20 years doing this work, and so we've really started with the idea of a home garden program. That's really the roots to our organization, that individuals could get access to 2 4x8 raised beds in their backyards and then be mentored and trained for 3 years, and really looking at that process of being able to become a lifelong food producer does take time. But we're also then mentoring folks along the way with other gardeners in their own neighborhood to then unite and build community together. So, you know, your question is, what does that look like to be a healthy, equitable community? Throughout our programs across, you know, our Youth Grow and our Let Us Grow program is really working in collaboration with folks and providing access to education. And that could be gardening education through our partnerships through Oregon State and Oregon Food Bank and Chemeketa Community College to then get certificates of completion after all of these sessions. But it's really uniting folks around that idea that we're here collectively together and we support everyone, no matter their background, that we're all together in this, and that we're here as an organization to support individuals to become what they want to be and what they want to have access to food-wise, but also in broader sense, connections to other parts of their communities that maybe they're not currently connected to.
So is it partly that, you know, you want to give communities sort of this choice, a choice of the food that they can eat, a choice of the how well they can live?
Yeah, it would be the idea that folks that we're in collaboration, that our programs are flexible enough to then say right now where we're at as an organization, if folks want to say, hey, we want to be doing more of this project, then we then start to change our programs and organization to then focus on that. We're not specific to one neighborhood in the city, or even just the city of Portland. We're in Clackamas and, you know, moving towards Milwaukee. We're also through our Let Us Grow program statewide. So from our prison garden programs to, you know, in Pendleton, in Ontario, to Tillamook, Salem. So we have a statewide reach as well. And so that we're able to then be flexible enough to then engage with folks in those communities on how they want to be engaged, and that it's a conversation, right? It's a collaboration, and that we're going in together to then build what that community wants.
So I want to dig into some of the programming.
Yeah.
Could you give us a description of the different programs you have at Growing Gardens?
Yeah. So we have three main programs. The one that really the roots is the Home Gardens program, which I described a little bit. But it's working with right now, we have over 300 families that are gardening through our three-year mentorship program. And we're out there working with folks. We have now hired 5 community organizers who have been graduates of the Home Gardens program back into our organization, who are then working in their own neighborhoods doing community work and community development, talking about our programs, but then also helping and mentoring other families throughout the process. We have our Youth Grow program. So we're working in 9 Title I elementary schools in 3 different districts. And it's really a connection to STEM and STEAM and science education that we're bringing the classroom out into the garden. But again, very similar to all of our programs, we're not just plopping in a garden and we're saying, great, good luck, school and teachers, have fun with this. But we're actually bringing in teachers and we're co-teaching with all of the teachers at that school. We're also bringing in curriculum. And then we're working with the PTA and administration to then change that culture to ensure that that garden is going to be sustainable at that school. Our last program is Let Us Grow, and it's working in 16 correctional facilities across the state of Oregon. We provide 9 months of curriculum, and then we're doing production. So last year, we produced over 225,000 pounds of produce that went back into prison kitchens. So one thing that's, you know, we're kind of talking about communities, that when folks end up in incarceration, that we don't really think about communities in prisons, but it's really something that then our programs really foster, and that prisons are racially generally segregated, and that folks kind of like stick with their own, you know, their race and background, and that the garden where we're at has become a safe space. And so that no matter what, folks can come into that garden and feel safe and build community within that. On average, an Oregon inmate is allotted $2.39 a day for 3 square meals. So it's something that we're then providing a benefit, right, for looking at the health and well-being of individuals, that 225,000 pounds of produce went in to meals to improve the diets of inmates. Another 35,000 pounds was donated to the Oregon Food Bank, and really looking at that restorative justice component to that program. So that's our main three programs. As any nonprofits, we're always kind of looking at how are we fundraising, what are our fundraising sources and our revenue streams. And so looking at grants and foundations, individual donors, and then our summer dinner series, The Chef in My Garden.
Yeah, so I want to jump into this fundraising series. It seems like it's an opportunity to have these kind of incredible one of a kind meals. How did the series begin?
Yeah, so we are in our 15th season of Chef in My Garden, and so it started with the idea of how to engage folks with our work, but with food, and looking at the food system. And how are folks throughout the whole process, from growing and producing to then, you know, chefs and kind of like the higher end part of this, how are we then uniting all of these together in an event? So the idea was that you'd have a chef and a winery, and then you'd be in a private secluded garden around the Portland metro area. And so we've really kind of expanded on that over the last couple of years. We have 6 dinners. Not to be, you know, over the top, but these are once in a lifetime opportunities, that they don't happen every year in the same setting with the same chef, the same winery. So they're very unique and elegant dinners, 5 to 7 course meals, that are really partnering with top end chefs, top wineries across the state. And then they're held in private secluded gardens.
So they're in gardens. Is that where ingredients are grown for the dinners?
Some of them, yeah. Some of them are grown there, but then a lot of them were sourced through a lot of partners that we have throughout the food system as well. So I'd say several in particular. Nikki USA has been a huge protein supporter of our series, and has been a huge support for us as an organization. So it's also a leverage point for this dinner series for us to engage with the business world as well, to then think about the food businesses that could be engaging with our work as well. So Nikki USA and Bob's Red Mill, Garden Fever has also been a great sponsor of ours, and then also Fish People Seafood.
Could you describe one of the upcoming dinners that you're most excited about?
It is very hard to choose because all 6 are truly amazing. But I'll, you know, play along with the question. I think for me, Maya Lovelace in May is going to be super exciting. So she's gotten a lot of press, has been nominated for a Rising Star James Beard Award. It's going to be held at this private garden. The owner is the former head gardener for Martha Stewart. It's overlooking Highway 30, and the backdrop is Mount St. Helens. Breathtaking. The other one I'm super excited about is Carlo Lamagna. He is now doing his Twisted Filipino pop-up, and so he really is going back to his food roots, which really is intriguing for us as an organization, because that's where we're going, and really looking at food and food sovereignty, and looking at how folks want to grow culturally appropriate things for their family and their communities. And so that also is another really intriguing dinner for me, with the Twisted Filipino.
And how did you get connected to the chefs that are participating?
Yeah, there's been a long history of cultivation. I'd say for one in particular, Jason French at Ned Ludd. He's been a part of all of our dinner series, and they've been in different kind of configurations. And this year, he's going to be at Lee Kelly's private studio out in Oregon City. So Lee Kelly, probably the most famous Oregon sculpturist, he opens up his private 2-acre lot that he's planted every single tree and plant on. So it's kind of like being in a live sculpture. He opens up his workshop, and people are there to come in and take a part of this amazing meal. So it's been a continuation and kind of cultivation of those relationships over time. And then new folks will come to us. We've worked with Little Green Pickle, the PR company, who's kind of connected us. Or chefs have said, hey, I want to do something else. I want to do something that's beneficial in my community as well. And so they'll reach out to us as well. So we'll kind of like work with folks and figure out how the best fitting and the best setting is for each dinner series.
We're about out of time, but I want to ask about sort of the future of Growing Gardens. What do you want to see the organization doing 5 or 10 years down the road?
Yeah, I mean, we've talked a lot about in our office about how to engage on a deeper level in our communities, but also in areas across the state. So on the east side of the state, in Central Oregon as well, and thinking about how to engage our communities and really highlight the work that's being done in growing food, but also building communities through that aspect. So I would love to have programs that are robust, that are engaging with folks, but also that are community driven and community led. And so we're bringing in more folks who are graduates of our programs as staff and on our board and advising and deciding where our organization goes.
Very cool. So before you go, how can people find more information about Growing Gardens in the Chef in My Garden series?
Yeah. So you can obviously Google us. Our website is a little tricky just in the sense that it's growing-gardens. Can kind of trip people up a lot. So growing-gardens.org is where you could find us. You can also look up just Chef in My Garden dinner series. It's pretty, that's easy to find. A lot of chefs are actually posting about this as well. So Pat Manning of Toro Bravo, it's going to be also a great meal. Rose City Raindrops are going to be there. The synchronized swimming troop are going to be there. So you can find it through kind of chefs, or you can look at growing-gardens.org.
Great. Jason, thank you so much for talking with me on the Food Show.
Thanks for having me.
That was Jason Skipton, Executive Director of Growing Gardens. We'll be back shortly with another food story, as well as our monthly garden segment with Marisha Auerbach. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. I'm Chris Siegel. I want to share with you another food story from my archive. This one is from writer and podcaster Nicola Twilley. Nicola created the website Edible Geography and is a regular contributor to The New Yorker. She also co-created the podcast Gastropod. In this story, Nicola talks about an experience where she got to peek behind the scenes of the process of getting bananas into the grocery. Here's Nicola Twilley.
This was in the autumn of 2011, and I was teaching a class at Columbia University, the first time I had ever taught at a university, and it was terrifying. And my class was called The Artificial Cryosphere, because I had recently become obsessed with refrigeration. And I had started working with a place called the Center for Land Use Interpretation about mapping America's refrigerated spaces. But as I started planning this class and, you know, laying out the curriculum and all of that, I realized I had never been inside a refrigerated warehouse. I mean, when you open your refrigerator door, it is actually the tip of a giant iceberg. And I wanted to peek behind the scenes into that sort of mechanically refrigerated world where our food lives. So I called this place called Banana Distributors of New York. And the guy who runs it, Paul Rosenblatt, picked up the phone and said, "Bananas." And I said, hello. And then I had to explain that I was teaching a class called The Artificial Cryosphere, which really made me regret that class name. And the guy was a sweetheart and let us come and visit. And basically what this place is it's 22 rooms dedicated, they're these pressurized, atmospheric, temperature-controlled rooms dedicated to ripening a banana. So you have to pick a banana when it's unripe, otherwise you can't ship it. Bananas, despite the fact that you don't keep them in the refrigerator, they are the ultimate refrigerated fruit. It is refrigeration that turned banana from something that was a tropical treat that most people who didn't live in the tropics had never seen into, you know, America's favorite fruit. But what happens is you harvest them when they're unripe, you put them in your refrigerated ship, you bring them to America, and then you have to kid them that they're back on the tree again and that they're going to get ripe. And that is where the ripening room comes in. And so it's a really interesting sort of vital step in the supply chain that, again, most people don't see. And you might think, well, at this point, surely you don't have to refrigerate the banana because you're trying to ripen it. Turns out you do. The heat coming off a room of ripening bananas, Paul told us, it can warm a small apartment. They actually experimented with capturing it and heating up the office space. So ripening bananas are hot. So he refrigerates heavily to keep them down to roughly 62 degrees. That's where ripening happens. This guy was a fountain of banana-related knowledge. I mean, he knew where the other banana ripening rooms are. There are four main ones that supply New York. He knew the entire history of banana ripening room design in the 70s, before the trade became palletized. Bananas used to be stacked by hand, and he still had some of those old rooms. He had the first two-tier banana ripening rooms in the world, an unacknowledged landmark in logistics history. And then he showed us the ethylene generators, which that's the plant ripening hormone. So these generators, they're called easy ripe generators, and they let the ethylene out, and gradually over a 24-hour period, the bananas are sort of gassed and become ripe. It smells disgusting. He opened the door on one of the just gassed rooms, and it smelled like I was face down in a frat house carpet. It was absolutely revolting, like spilt beer, sort of ripe and fruity and yeasty and gross. And that's what does it. The easy ripe generators are an innovation within his lifetime. He told us you used to have to sort of inject the gas from a cylinder, and it's very explosive. So fatal banana ripening room explosions were not actually uncommon. And you know, bananas would go flying through the air, breaking windows, etc. Used to be a more dramatic business. But it was just seeing that he hopes his father was in the banana trade, but he's hoping his kids won't go into it. And increasingly, actually, companies are ripening their bananas en route in containers. So the ripening rooms may well go extinct. But yeah, it was just a peek behind the scenes. And I think that is what that idea of sort of looking behind the scenes at the infrastructure of our food system and making it visible, you know, to people, that's what I'm all about.
That was a story from Nicola Twilley. In a moment, we'll be talking with Marisha Auerbach for our monthly garden segment. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. I'm Chris Siegel. Summer is finally here. That means all that hard work and preparation you've taken in the garden is starting to pay off. But just because we're getting to harvest doesn't mean it's time to take a break in the garden. There is a lot to be done to achieve a solid harvest. To help us stay organized, I'm joined by Marisha Auerbach for our monthly garden segment. Marisha, welcome back to The Food Show.
Thanks, Chris. It's so good to be here throughout the seasons as we go through the wheel of the year, and here we are at the peak.
So this is an exciting time in the garden, as the garden really takes off. What are you enjoying most about the garden right now?
You know, I thought about this as I was watering this morning, and I've been really enjoying all of the textures and color combinations that I didn't really completely plan out, and as the flowers come into bloom and they pop, just how good all these things look together and how it changes, you know, week by week. And there are days when certain things are at their peak. And I've also been enjoying checking out the feedback loops of how well I've done with some of my perennials over the years. The current fruit fly is a big problem for a lot of us here in Portland, and I've been working with that over the past couple of years, and it's neat to see how attention has been able to affect my harvest.
I feel like I understand when you talk about texture, one of the things about planting a garden is that you leave so much space when the plants are little, and we're getting to that time where it's like, oh, everything's filling out. It looks more full, whereas at the beginning of the season it looked kind of thin. So I feel like summer has snuck up on us. What can we still plant in order to harvest this summer?
You know, I think we can still plant basil. And that's one of the great things that I think about when you're talking about texture, because there's the purple ruffles basil. I've got some lettuce leaf ruffled basil, where you get some more texture than those smooth leaves. And also shiso is another plant that came up for me that you can still plant now that adds color and texture to the garden and can fill in these spaces. I think this week is probably the last week to get in tomatoes and peppers, some of the earlier season ones. We can still sneak in some squashes and beans and, you know, radishes, of course, because you'll want to do those every 2 weeks, and lettuces, as long as it's a cool microclimate. So there's a lot that can go in, but I think that really starts to, you know, we just passed the solstice. I think that was yesterday evening, or for some today, and that's when it really changes. From the solstice is like the last ditch effort to put in the summer veggie crops, and then I think I tend to take a break for about 2 weeks and then start focusing on the winter garden.
So I want to look ahead then. What can we do now to get ready for that fall and winter garden?
Compost. You know, collecting organic matter, tending to the compost pile once the temperature subsides, turning it so that you can accelerate the way that it turns over to get some aged compost. Aged compost is perfect for things that are in their vegetative state as they move into fruiting and flowering. And as plants have been in the ground for a bit, it's nice to give them that top dressing, which also the compost will also help hold water in the soil.
And then anything else to start thinking about planting right now that we want to harvest in the fall or winter?
Brussels sprouts, I think, is good to plant now. I planted some in May. I think that May, June is really the time. It's hard to find the sweet spot since they're so difficult to grow. You can do succession plantings of carrots or parsnips or beets. And garlic will be ready to harvest pretty soon.
And you've mentioned some brassicas. You've mentioned this idea of the microclimates. So we're going to be encountering some pretty hot days. What are things we can do for plants that like it a little bit cooler?
Well, watering them in the morning to cool them down is really helpful. I like to have plants that are in pots that I can move to give them some shade. Just planting those brassicas if you know that they're going to be in the garden at this time of year, it's nice to be able to plant them in a microclimate that's cooler. You know, I plant mine where they get shade at around 2 p.m. And I saw this amazing technique in Belize that a traditional farmer that I work with does, and he has little Y-shaped posts made out of branches put throughout his garden so that as it reaches high noon, he will take some palm leaves off the pathway and put them on these posts so that he can have shade for the crops that need it. And that's how he's able to grow some amazing crops that we grow in the cool season in the heat of the summer in Belize.
You mentioned watering in the morning. What other tips do you have to keep the garden irrigated as we have less and less rain?
Yeah, adding that compost is crucial because compost tends to help hold water. Also, being able to plant to maximize your space to discourage evaporation. Being able to water early in the morning so that the plants can uptake as much water before it gets too hot, and avoiding getting water on their leaves so they don't get burned are all good techniques. When we water at night, it tends to be a time when fungal disease spreads and the plants aren't receptive to water in the evening. They're receptive as the sun comes up until high noon, and that's the best time to make sure you get that water in.
So a lot of my plants have really taken off in this past week, and that means that they're absorbing more and more nutrients from the soil. You've mentioned compost a few times, but I'm curious what things we can do to improve soil fertility in the garden.
Yeah, I mentioned top dressing with compost. Compost tea is a tremendously helpful thing to do. You can make compost tea every 2 weeks. We actually do it with our worm castings. And then we both use it as a foliar feed as well as a spray on the soil. And this helps fight a lot of diseases as well. And it's like a multivitamin for your plants. So that's really helpful. And then depending on what sort of nutrient deficiencies you might observe, then there's other sorts of things that you can do to amend the soil.
Do you have a good recipe for compost tea?
Oh, I think it's like 4 cups worm castings in our big brewer. I'm terrible with numbers. I don't remember what size our brewer is. We have one of the Vortex compost tea brewers. So it really depends on what size your brewer is, and you want to make sure that you aerate it to encourage the microbes that you want.
So I want to jump into outside of the annuals. What are things we can be doing right now as our perennial crops are moving throughout the season.
Harvest. You know, I mean, I think if we're talking about berries, you know, one thing that we really need to look out for is the spotted-winged Drosophila. The spotted-winged Drosophila is a fruit fly that has about 13 generations per season, and it loves soft fruit. Any soft fruit, from, you know, raspberries right now to your sun gold tomatoes at the end of the year when they crack, they'll have those spotted-winged Drosophilas living in them. And what they do to our raspberries is we'll go and to harvest them, and they'll just kind of drip down. So if you harvest your raspberries regularly and don't let them get overripe, then you can prevent the spotted-winged Drosophila. You can thin your berries to make sure there's good airflow. That also helps discourage the pest. And I have some vinegar traps out there to discourage the spotted-winged Drosophila, but it'll hit any soft fruit. So whether you've got, you know, whatever you have that's overripe. And I like to go through the garden about every 3 days to do a pick to make sure I'm getting the things that are ready. So I have my students say the mantra of pick it small, pick it often. You know, it's good to tend to the garden every 3 days with harvest, because then you'll really maximize your harvest.
And that's the best part anyways, the picking part. So.
It sure is.
So the increased sun is also helping out all the weeds in the garden. Do you have any advice about how to keep those weeds at bay?
Well, I think one of the best times to pull weeds is right before they flower. So when you have a lot of little weeds in the ground, they often aren't doing as much damage as once they get bigger and they start to flower. Then they're easier to pull, and that's when you really prevent them from spreading seed. Knowing how weeds reproduce is important for preventing weeds. Some weeds will spread underground by their rhizomes or their roots, like morning glory. And so there you want to have more receptive soils, and you want to stay on top of it to be able to actually eradicate morning glory. But other things will spread their seed, and then it's best to just get them before they flower, because there's many weeds that will produce seed out of the ground after they've flowered. You know, like someone might recall pulling a dandelion and leaving it on the ground. If it was in flower, it turns to seed, and then it's flying all over the place. Weeds are known for producing seed exponentially.
So we're about out of time, but I want to ask what if you have any workshops or events coming up, and how can people learn more about what you do?
Well, my website is permaculturerising.com, and this Saturday is going to be my last plant sale of the summer season. So if anyone has space in their garden for things, I've got lots of varieties of tomatoes and peppers and squash and some perennials, all sorts of things. I've got a lot of diversity available still, and this is the last weekend, I think, to get stuff in. So that can be found on permaculturerising.com. And then the next workshop in my monthly workshop series on Grow Your Own Produce is going to be a field trip. And that's on the first Tuesday in Tuesday, July 11th. It's actually the second Tuesday in July. And it's going to be focusing on berries, herbs, and water catchment.
Marisha, thank you so much for joining me on The Food Show.
Thanks, Chris.
That was Marisha Auerbach with our monthly garden segment. For more information about the classes Marisha offers, you can visit her website, permaculturerising.com, or head on over to the food show page of the KBOO website. In a moment, we'll hear one last food story. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. I'm Chris Siegel. I have one last story for you. This one is from storyteller Brian Rohr. While the previous two stories were personal, Brian is a professional storyteller, so he told us a fictional story about an apple tree. If you are able to, I highly encourage you to turn down the lights and close your eyes while listening to this story. Here's Brian Rohr.
So stories like this one are basically stories that you just imagine yourself at a pub, at some ancient pub, all right, with a glass of mead or some old cider that's been brewing for a really long time, with the storyteller sitting on top of the bar, everyone gathered around with their pints. That's this kind of a story that we're gonna hear. So it was a long, 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 long time ago, back in some ancient land, back in some ancient place, in some ancient time, there was a tree. Not just any tree. This was an apple tree, an old, gnarly, beautiful apple tree. Some say, in fact, it may be the first apple tree that ever came into existence. But regardless of that, what we know is that this tree, this beautiful apple tree, had the most delicious apples in all the land. The best, most delicious apples. And there was an old woman who was the steward of this tree. And she loved this tree. She loved this tree more than anything else. But here's the thing. The thing that pissed her off, the thing that got her goat more than anything else, was the fact that people would come all the time and steal the apples off the tree. If they would only ask, it would be fine. She would give them some apples, no problem, but they never came and asked. They always just came and stole from the tree. Oh, and it made her so angry. One day, there was a knock on her door. And she went and she opened the door. And there was this person there, this stranger she'd never seen before. And the person said, "Hello, I am a wanderer. I'm a traveler. And I noticed this apple tree out front. I wonder if I might have an apple to take with me on my journey." And the old woman, oh my gosh, someone finally asked her for an apple. Someone asked, they requested it. And she was so excited. She went out there herself. She picked so many apples, put them in a bag for him, gave it to him. And he was about to leave and he said, "You know, for your generosity, I'm going to grant you a single wish. Anything you want, it'll be yours." Whoa, this delighted the old woman, and she thought about it, and she thought about it. First, she was like, "Whoa, maybe I can have gold. But what good is gold? What do I need gold for? What else? What else? What else?" And then she got it. She said, "What I wish for is that anyone who takes an apple from my tree is stuck to the tree until I let them go." And the traveler said, "So it is." And she turned and looked at the tree to see if anything changed. The tree still looked like it always did. She turned back to the traveler, but the traveler was gone. Well, by and by, she was inside her place, having a little bit of breakfast, when all of a sudden, from outside, she heard some screaming, the screaming of some kids. "Let me down, let me down, let me down." And she went outside. She saw there were three kids just hanging in the tree. She said, "Let me down, let me down, let us out. We're stuck here. We can't get down. Let us down." And the old woman just cackled and laughed and laughed and said, "No, I'm not letting you down anytime soon." And she went back inside. Well, some time later, she heard some other voices from out front, and she went outside, and there in the tree was the banker, was the schoolmaster, was a priest and a rabbi and imam, and all these people were just hanging off this tree, just hanging there. He said, "Let us down, let us down." And she said, "No, I'm not letting you down. I'm not letting you down." And by the end of the day, there were so many people hanging off this tree. She went outside. She said, "Listen, I will let you down only and only if you promise that you'll never steal apples from this tree again." "Okay, okay, we promise, we promise we won't steal a tree. Just let us down, let us down." So she let everyone down and they went on her way, and she went inside feeling very pleased with herself. Well, some time passed, and one day there was a knock at her door, and she opened the door, and there was a stranger there, though the stranger was very familiar to her. She could tell by the look in the stranger's eyes. They were dark, they were deep. You looked in and you saw universes and universes, but even more, you saw into the deep void. And she knew that this was the spirit of death himself. And she said to him, "Well, what do you want?" And he said, "I've come to take you on a long journey that everyone must walk." And she said, "Well, if I must go, I must, but I'm sure the journey is long and I will get hungry. Do you mind if I take a snack with me?" And he said, "Oh, no problem, just hurry up." And she said, "Well, how about this? I'll take care of putting the cheese together inside here. Why don't you go out to the apple tree and pick a few apples? And that way we'll have some food for our journey." And so she went inside, and Death went to the apple tree. And sure enough, Death got stuck to the apple tree. "Let me down! Let me down!" Death screamed. "Let me down!" And she went out there and she looked at Death and she said, "No way. I am not letting you down." And days went by, weeks went by, months went by, years went by, and she still didn't let Death free. And all over the world, people weren't dying. You know, people all of a sudden might get run over by a carriage, but they didn't die. People may get sick, but they didn't die. People may get old, but they didn't die. The balance of the world was off. At first, everyone was happy, but, you know, over time, people started to realize maybe having death in this world isn't such a bad thing. One day after 10 years went by, Death said, "Please, you must let me down. The balance is so off in the world. The balance is so off." And she said to him, "I will let you down if you promise me, if you promise me that you will not come for me until I choose." He said, "That is impossible. No one can determine the time of their own death." And she said, "Then I will not let you down." He said, "Fine, fine. I make that promise." And so she let Death down, and order was restored in the world once again. And they say that maybe it was that this old woman lived out a good long life, and finally one day she was ready to die. Others say that she is still alive to this day. And there are those out there who say that her name was Misere, and maybe that is why there is still some misery in this world. At least that's what they say. That's how it happened. And that is all I know. Thank you so much.
That was storyteller Brian Rohr. And that's it for this episode of the KBOO Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. I want to thank our guests, Jason Skipton, Marisha Auerbach, Brian Wilkie, Nicola Twilley, and Brian Rohr for being on today's show. I also want to thank our fantastic board operator, Tammy. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives. And don't forget to tune in again next month on the third Wednesday of July for another episode of The Food Show. Until then, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening.
Some food in my belly. Some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't
all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size or perfect, because you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food. Working those lands for corporations don't do hungry people no good, because people need food in their belly. Some drink for the dying their throat, for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dying their throat, and need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right to cut the trees down just to grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat? You know those trees, they hold the topsoil, and those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protect them, put tax dollars where they need to be. 'Cause people need food in their belly. Some drink for the dry in their throat, and need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Got to have food in their belly.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival, happening June 30th through July 4th from noon to 10 p.m. Single-day passes are now available, as well as the Blues Buddy Pass, the Benefactor Pass, and many other options to enjoy the blues in person. Again, that's the 30th Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, benefit for the Oregon Food Bank. Saturday, June 30th through July 4th, noon to 10 p.m. at Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm/WBF2017.
KBOO Community Radio will be broadcasting live from the 25th Annual Good in the Hood Multicultural Music and Food Festival. Saturday, June 24th, will be on-site at Lillis Albina Park and will broadcast the festival from 1:30 to 9:30 p.m.
One more time.
Tune in to hear sets from Surround Sound, No Limits, In Touch, Tamara Stevens, and more. Again, that's a live broadcast from Good in the Hood, Saturday, June 24th, starting at 1:30 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And it's time for Jazz Lives on your community radio station, KBOO Portland, 90.7